Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going. Welcome. Today's guest, Jeff Borshewa, is an author, podcaster, and general nonlinear thinker who obsesses over the miracle that is humanity. Welcome, my friend.
Well, thank you, Brian, and thank you for having me on the show with you.
Oh, my God, it's my pleasure. You're one of my favorite people, and I have no idea where this conversation is going to go, but it's going to be good. It's going to be perfect.
Guaranteed weird. We already established that. So
Yes. You know, I think you should add the title of community builder slash connector to your resume as well.
Would you believe I'm trying to figure that out? The working words I had was whale hunter because I love going after them. But then I was like, that doesn't end well for the whale. So I'm either the whale whisperer or the whale watcher. But yes, it's part of what it's in my DNA. I am a diehard Go-Giver fan, and everything I do is about bringing great people together. So it's kind of my greatest high is making artful connections. Given the nature of the show is about creativity, I jokingly say that I want to elevate networking to an art form.
Wow. Well, and I think, you know, that does feel so authentic. And I think, you know, now more than ever, people are wanting authenticity and are tired of all the noise and the scheming and the, you know what I mean? Just the falsehoods behind a lot of marketing and just stuff that's going on in the world in general, correct? So, I mean, it's kind of
Absolutely.
Like your time, our time.
Well, and I like to say there's never been a better time to be a nerd and be alive. I mean, it's, you know, AI is just expanding what's possible. And yes, I know there's the doom and gloom negative Nellies, but, you know, you and I were talking before we hit record about turning your poems into songs. I'm weird. So every now and then I'll write a LinkedIn post and I'll turn it into a Shakespearean sonnet. Why not? Right?
Yeah, why not? So, well, what is it that inspires you to build community and champion others?
I think, you know, if it's fair to say I am addicted to the dopamine hits that I get from connecting great people. As an example, and I hope she doesn't mind me sharing this, connecting you with our mutual friend, Hallelujah Johnson, knowing that two creative, amazing humans came together and you're collaborating, that brings me intense joy. Now, for the record, I'm supposed to stop and figure out how do I make money doing some of these things? But there's certain connections, and you know this, and I'm happy to always do this. I connect certain people just because the universe screams in my ear and says, you've got to connect these people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's just that, you know, just that adage of just giving you shall receive. And we don't always know how it's going to come back to us. And that's not the point why we do it. You know what I mean? It's from our heart because we really enjoy the authentic connections that come from it. But yet, it is interesting sometimes to see how maybe a connection does come around in the future to, I don't know, to benefit us, to help everybody. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And for what it's worth, so one of my inspirations, if people listening to this have not read The Go-Giver by Bob Berg and John David Mann, it is literally my Bible. It's my filter. If people don't believe in Go-Giver, I don't need to talk to them any further. And for the record, you're a Go-Giver, whether you would use that term or not. But the aha moment for that, somewhere along the line, I'm happy to say I'm now friends with Bob Berg. I absolutely adore the man. He quoted Randy Gage, who says, "You can't outgive the universe." And honestly, Brian, my stubborn brain went, "Wanna bet?" Now, for the record, I fully expect to lose. I am not delusional. I am not arrogant. But it occurred to me that is probably true. And there's zero chance I lose by trying to outgive the universe.
I
And
like
so
that.
that's been my inspiration. And I'm taking it up a notch because to me, the more people I connect, and I'm just going to say that we have this trust deficit. People are splintered and scattered, and there's us versus them everywhere. When you do networking and you bring the right people together, none of that crap matters. It's about how do we make the world a better place together. And so to be honest, I get a bit of a contact high from watching great people do great things.
Well, you're appreciated. I appreciate you, and I know so many other people do too. And if more people took this, this outlook that you're sharing, and that you're I don't know, just showing up in the world as, I mean, oh my God, everything, this world would be such a better place. And we need everybody. We need to connect. We need to collaborate. I mean, it's our true nature, I believe, and it's so easy to get isolated in today's world with all the tech. And it's just, I'm so glad I grew up when I did without the tech, to be able to kind of like, play in my little world and be creative and in the ways that were fun and I guess beneficial for me now. But it would not be easy to be a kid these days.
I can't even fathom, and this is going to sound really weird, and people can think what they will. But when I was a kid, I grew up on a farm. We had two television channels, three if the wind was blowing the right direction. So television was off in the summers because too much heat in the house. We spent afternoons laying out on fresh cut lawns, looking up and looking at the clouds and looking for the formations, watching the stars at night, watching northern lights. It's amazing that I look at my kids and they don't have that deliberate downtime. It's go, go, go. They're at school all day and they're juggling classes and devices and technology. And then they come home and there's devices and technology everywhere here. And we're always on the way to something or coming back from something. There's not that playful, imaginary, we spent cold winters, we'd stay indoors and we'd mix bubble solution and make our own bubbles and we'd spend it all day blowing bubbles. Like, I don't think my kids have ever done that other than, the store-bought jar where you go outside and the wind blows them everywhere. But we're just not playing enough is I think that's the word I'm going to use is we don't play enough anymore, Brian.
Yeah, how do you, well, I know, with your kids, it probably enables you to maybe possibly play a little bit more than the average adult, but I mean, what do you do nowadays to kind of recapture some of that?
Well, it's absolutely fascinating because, like most parents, I woke up, I signed up for the job thinking it's my job to teach them and to bring them through the world. And early on, I was blessed enough to look at them and go, holy crap, they're the teacher if I'm ready to be the student. And so So first of all, I've always been an overgrown child. I am very immature mentally. I like to play. I like to look for, give me rhyming schemes and let me play with words, and I just nerd out for hours. But
Right there with you.
with my kids, one of the things I do, so in business, I'm obsessed with habits and rituals and processes and systems. What I realized watching my kids was that video games, not always the perfect teacher, but watching how my kids engage with it, I started playing with my kids and I started asking them questions. They thought it was father-son time and we were enjoying playing a video game together, which it was, but I was also learning how and why they played, and I was watching what engaged them. And now, they're getting older, they're both in their teens now, we actually have long discussions, because this is what weirdos do. We discuss the quote unquote economies of the video games they like. We look at the mechanics of it. We look at, what is the game doing to move the user forward? I'm sure most people listening going, wow, that sounds boring, but it is my kids and I, we're playing with the idea of playing, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, no, I mean, I love that. And it's just, you guys are connecting at the same time, they're learning, you're learning, you're sharing time together. And you're nerding out all at the same time.
And for what it's worth, we call it car coaching. And I've had a few parents say, you should record that because, I want my kid to be mentored by someone who understands business. And I'm like, no, first of all, no, because it is very private, intimate time with my kids. We're talking about their deepest thoughts and things. But what I do with that is I create my content. I actually, a lot of what I do in business now, believe it or not, Brian, is contributed by my kids. So when they were going through elementary school science and we were talking about the forces of flight, all of a sudden the forces of flight made an appearance on my LinkedIn content. My youngest son is now studying ancient machines in science class. So of course we're now my posts are starting to communicate about leverage and the pulleys and things like that. But what I realized, and I hope somebody listening out there hears this, I used to think I had roles. There's my job as a husband, my job as a father, entrepreneur. And then I was like, wait a minute, there's just one me, and I'm a crazy mixture of all of these things. So now everything I do is who I am. And I think that's been huge because, again, I'm neurodiverse, non-linear thinking is my thing. You want to watch my head explode? Tell me I got to do the same thing five times.
I think we're very similar in that regard too. I think, the way I show up is kind of what really brings me joy and what I enjoy doing, there's really something to be said about that. And I consider ourselves both very lucky.
Absolutely. And, we were talking about health. And, one of the things I've found is that life's short. We've got to put the most in that we can. And, I'll share a summer project I have this summer. I'm building a mentoring program to teach my kids the fundamentals of being entrepreneurs. Now, last summer they got the workbook. Yes, Dad wrote a workbook, and I wrote out, here's the life skills I think you need that you're not getting from school. And it was 400 page workbook. My wife rolled her eyes and said, there's no way they're doing that. I had to throttle my 12-year-old at the time, I had to slow him down because he was trying to zoom through the whole thing. So he was like full throttle. And I'm like, no, buddy, absorb, digest, move. So last summer was a lot of theory. And the reason I did that was I wanted them to learn communication skills, thinking skills, technology skills. Surprise, surprise, we didn't get into things like math and science and physics and stuff. But this summer, the aha moment for me was I'm a business coach at heart. I will coach people just for fun. I coach people for money. The aha moment was, of all the things I can teach my kids, how to think like an entrepreneur and how to measure things and make decisions is probably the most important. I can teach them how to change a tire, I can teach them how to change their oil. Or I can teach them the entrepreneurial skills where they can afford to hire somebody to do it for them. So this summer, both of my boys have, they've got 2 weeks of, sorry, 2 months of freedom left. But July 1st, when summer starts, each of them is required to plan, start, and launch their own business. And the only criteria is it's got to be something easy for their level, and it's got to be something that could self-sustain once they go back to school in the fall. So for our boys and the way I'm working on it, it's going to be predominantly digital content or digital products. I don't want, the nerd in me, I want to put out the lemonade stand and build them a lemonade stand, but
I had one of those as a kid.
exactly. It was a rite of passage back then, and we sat there and drank our own lemonade because I lived on a farm, nobody drove past. But I do want it to be something, I don't want to have to worry about fulfillment and procurement and blah blah blah. I just want it to be create it once and sell it. So
This, thank you for sharing that. This reminds me of the Rich Dad Poor Dad book. I actually listened to it again not too long ago. Teaching real world skills, and I hand it to you for that.
It's funny that you bring it up because before I knew I was having kids, once I got married and my wife said, okay, we're gonna have children at some point, I bought the Cash Flow Club game, and then there's a Cash Flow Club for kids, and there's a book. And I was like, there is zero chance my kids are growing up not knowing this stuff. So it's kind of evolved over time.
Wow, that's awesome. So, what does success mean to you?
Success is a fantastic word, and I love that you're asking people to define it because I get a lot of people making assumptions about me based on what they see. And it is fascinating to me because the things they think I think are successful have no meaning to me whatsoever. So my version of success is it's based on freedom. So first and foremost, I am a child, I do not belong in boardrooms. I will have a tantrum if you make me go to a board meeting. So success to me is the freedom to work with who I want, when I want, where I want, and how I want. And I can't remember where I got that from, but to me, that was just it's about having impact, it's about helping people, and the byproduct of all of that is I like to get paid and I like to make a good living, but I've always been inspired. There's some ancient story about a fisherman who moves to Mexico and, or sorry, a fisherman from Mexico. He's visited by some venture capitalist who says, you should work harder and buy more boats and, work 20 years in the city and then you could come back and retire and spend more time with your family. And the fisherman looked at him and said, but I do that already. So to me, it's going to sound weird, but I'm treading water, building the foundation of the family business. And when my boys are ready, I'm going to tailor the business to suit them. I'm not going to transition dad's version of a business to them, but I'm going to help them build their version. Success to me will be playing with my boys into their adulthood.
That's wonderful.
And if I may, one thing
Please.
a lot of people go, oh, that's too young. My boys are 13 and 17. They say, oh, that's too young. They won't understand that. Fundamental correction or problem, these kids have been raised by me, and my wife, and they think that I'm normal. To them, I'm just dad. So we have conversations about global supply and demand. We can talk about price curves. They're little nerds. They were raised from birth to be entrepreneurs. So I laugh when people say, "Oh, kids can't understand that stuff." And it's like, I have a feeling it's more you're afraid that the adult doesn't understand and therefore can't explain it. The secret is I ask my kids to tell me what they think something means before we even start the conversation.
Well, they're definitely chips off the old block. What does your wife think of all this?
It is fascinating, Brian, because she grew up, she wants to make sure they have the security of a job. She had some childhood issues. She wants to have that safety. But she's accepting, and now she sees it, that our kids weren't meant to sit in a classroom for the rest of their days. They are non-linear thinkers, and one of my biases, I do not begrudge anyone who says, you should go to college, get an education. I believe in that. What I don't believe is going there, mindlessly memorizing things, cramming it in your head that you're never going to use.
Yes.
I'm more about practical hands-on application. So, to keep the peace in our household, the plan is both of my boys will start and run their own businesses. They cannot interfere with school in any way. And if they should choose to go to school, they're going to run the business on the side rather than, back in the day when I was a kid, you got that crappy job waiting tables or cleaning toilets or whatever.
Lifeguarding.
Yeah. So that's the idea is, I want them to get real world skills next to their college theoretical skills, because I'm going to be really blunt. My wife is in an industry where they're getting a lot of college graduates who literally don't know how to write an email. They don't know how to, in business terms, they don't know how to tie their own damn shoelaces. Like literally, they're struggling with the basics of how do you address an envelope? How do you write an email? How do you set your out of office on your voicemail? Like these kids are coming out with student loan debt, lots of academic learning, but no practical life skills whatsoever.
Well,
They don't even know
yeah.
how to do interviews or to do, like it's just, I'm not kidding. One had to come and ask the manager, I've never done this before. I want to quit my job. How do I do that?
Oh
And I
boy.
was like, oh my God.
Well, that's another reason why I guess I'm glad I grew up when I did. You kind of had to bootstrap things a little bit more, and through the bootstrapping, you learned, a lot of those things that maybe they aren't being taught these days or were forced to learn. Just through just kind of every day, and survival is not the right word exactly, but just living when we did in that time period of
Well,
just
one
kind of.
thing I saw that really resonated, Brian, was, back in the day, we were the generation of latchkey kids and, we were at home alone and, we had to figure stuff out and we didn't have the internet. And I think that's the biggest thing. I love the internet. It's a miracle. There's a lot of cool stuff out there, but you don't have to earn the knowledge anymore. You can just watch YouTube and go, oh, that's how you change a tire. Whereas back in the day, I remember first time I changed a tire, my dad gave me the tire iron, the jack, and said, have at her. And then he laughed his butt off while I tried to figure it out.
Well,
The other
go
thing that's
ahead.
actually interesting is now, I read somewhere that, if you look at the new generations coming out, they're more afraid to try and fail. Because if they happen to, for me, failure just means experience. I learned how not to do something. And you think about our childhoods, the weird stuff we would have done, jumping ramps with our bikes and so on. Now all of that gets captured on cell phones and video. And next thing you know, your worst events and your worst moments end up on TikTok. So there's a lot of public shaming over learning, which to me is a tragedy.
Yeah, I never thought about it like that. You're absolutely right. And just so much pressure just to be. I mean, I suppose with they're comparing everybody, to their peers through video and social media, and the way that it works probably is that we're comparing our worst, which only we really see, compared to like what looks like is their best, which we're not seeing their worst. You know what I'm saying? And so it just,
Yep.
it's a tough thing. It's hard enough to
You
be
know,
a kid as it is, you know, and grow up and learn. But you
yeah,
throw all this other
everybody
stuff.
wants to be the professional basketball player. Nobody wants to be the kid who falls on his face 10 times trying to dunk. And we forget the journey. You know, you think about how we got to where we are today. I mean, anything we've done worth doing, we sucked at it at some point.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I just look at my own journey as a writer, you know, over the last 15, 16 years, and oh, it's just, I'm so much better now, you know, and it just, you just, less is more in everything, especially writing. And back in the day, I thought, oh, I can't get rid of this. It's so dear or tender or goofy or whatever to me. But it's just like, it's extra. It needs to go. You're being repetitive, what have you. But yeah, gotta get out there and do it and just let it evolve.
You know, and for what it's worth, you mentioned writing. My first book is out there somewhere, and man, does it stink. I've read it again, and I'm like, ooh, that was so. This is going to sound like a criticism, but it's actually me talking about me, so it's okay. It reads like it was written by an accountant who was trying to explain technology to other accountants, which, if you know, you know, accountants are high fact finders, so it's very technical, very dry, very textbooky. And it's not one of those things somebody's going to sit down and, you know, it's not Shakespeare. It's not something that's going to inspire you. My wife jokingly said, whenever I have trouble sleeping, I just read the first chapter of your book. And I don't disagree with her because, now, for the record, it was written for a specific audience at a specific time. You would not catch me dead trying to write something like that today. I do not do textbooks anymore because they're boring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody evolves, right? I mean, I'm not the same person I was last week, you know, let alone last year or 2 years ago or 10 years ago. And it is interesting looking back. I mean, yeah, I've looked at some of my first poems, and you know, hey, it was a, you know, gotta give that first crack and just kind of keep moving forward, no matter what it is.
You know, this is an old reference, but I'm sure at some point, Bill Watterson from Calvin and Hobbes or Scott Adams with Dilbert, I'm sure their very first cartoons were kind of primitive. I'd love to see those. But you can see how their art evolved over the years. You see it with actors, with singers. True art, and I don't care what you do, if you take pride in it and it's your joy, I will say I've seen people, don't judge me, Brian, but people making Dairy Queen ice cream sundaes and taking great pride in how the little loop at the top looks. To me, that's art. You know, it's art is everywhere if we look for it. And you know, I find a particular obsession with watching people waxing floors. I love watching them wax lobbies in big buildings. It just mesmerizes me. So that's my version of art for whatever it's worth.
No, I love it. I mean, if you really think about it, everything that we come across in our daily life or just looking out the window was somebody's idea at one time. You know, and we just get so accustomed just to kind of being, you know, just forgetting about that. But it's, man, you know, it's the world is our oyster.
And honestly, I mean, if you think about it, like I'm strange, and I say that by my own admission, just so that people don't think the need to tell me. But one of my favorite things, so Brian, I'm going to share one of my new art mediums. It is a very strange one, and you're going to love it because I've been playing with this medium for the last couple of weeks. And are you ready for it?
Drum roll, yes.
It is the human smile. So
Whoa.
everywhere I go, everyone I encounter out in the real world as I'm out doing my day, my mission is to find something sincere and genuine about them and compliment it. And I walk away, they've given me the gifts of their smiles, and it ripples. I can see people around me smiling because I'm smiling.
Yeah.
And I used to think this was new age woo-woo weirdo stuff, but the reality is, when I give smiles away, I always get them back in tenfold. It's, trying to outgive the universe. But I used to think being generous meant you gave people things. Now I'm focusing on giving them their sense of pride. And I'm going to give you a weird example because it was absolutely fascinating. My son and I went into a retail store, and the worker there was very clearly proud of how she was putting the store together and managing things and so on. And I just said, look, I don't want to sound like a weirdo, but I just want you to know I see what you're doing organizing this. I know that's not easy. I appreciate the effort. Thank you. It
Wow.
was, and we walked out, and the best part, Brian, was my son was like, Dad, why did you say it that way? Why did you? He was actually analyzing the compliment so that he could replicate it later. And I was like, oh my God, I'm teaching without meaning to teach. But then the next week we walked by the store. We didn't go in, but she came out and said hi to my son and asked him how his purchase had been and if he had any suggestions for her. And I saw, and this is going to sound really weird, but I saw a retail person step into her power and own it as, she was as proud as a shop owner who just sold her first thing. She was very proud about what she'd done. But my son was also very proud that someone had asked his opinion. And I watched the two of them smiling at each other and I went, holy crap, that's a boomerang smile. So that's my new addiction. I mean, literally, I know, the universe, everybody wants to talk about money and business and stuff, but creating smiles, they're so perfect because they're so transient. They don't last, but they ripple. And that just to me is just nerdy, fantastically fun. Sorry.
No, thank you for that's beautiful story. And it's as simple as, well, just like if you're at a four-way stop or something, letting somebody go in front of you, like you both go there at the same time, you say you give them a wave, and everybody feels better, and the people who witness it feel better, and it is amazing how that does ripple.
Well, and it's funny because I think the term is microaggressions. You get people who slam on the brakes at the four-way and so they can go in front of everybody. And it's like you think about the energy. I don't know what the opposite of microaggression is, but maybe microkindnesses. A microaggression, it takes energy from everybody involved, the witnesses, the participants, everybody. But a micro kindness, like I saw people watching my son and this retail person interacting, and they were smiling, walking past, having seen the smiles. So, they always say kindness is free. But seriously, what they don't say is what an amazing gift you're giving to yourself by being kind to others, because they'll be kind back.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you for that. That was lovely. God, we have so much to
So
talk. No, what were you gonna say?
I was just going to say, it's not my typical discussions. Usually I'm talking about business, but the aha moment is, and for people who are interested, if you're treating people like this in business, guess what? They bring their friends, they bring their clients. I'm a big believer in earning re referrals and building relationships. Coming back to what we started with, I see humanity as sort of my portfolio, and I'm going to invest a little bit in everybody. I don't expect a return from any of them, but I know with absolute certainty by being kind to others and trying to outgive that universe, the kindness comes back to me in ways I never expected. And the obvious one that people want to measure is that's where I get my clients from. It's where I get my paycheck from. It's how I make my living is serving others and having them appreciate it and give me introductions back that grow my business. So,
No, I love that. And I kind of got a little bit of taste of that when I was in Los Angeles for those 10 years that I acted. And, I'd show up and I'd be reliable and, just myself. And I would get called back a lot or referred to, other people, or if they had another project, they'd remember me. And I mean, it's just, it makes such a difference. And to me, it's just being myself. And it's not really, I'm not doing anything out of the ordinary. However, yeah. It just it, it's and we just we're happier, we feel better when we're like that.
And the good news is we can get out of the way and let the people who've had way too much coffee make it to work faster. And they're just racing to get to the finish line, which is an early grave. I'm happy to let them take my place in that line. I'll wait.
So you're an author, you're a podcast host. I've been a guest on your wonderful show, and I've always enjoyed chatting with you. You're an AI deep diver, and you do a lot of different things. What is it about? Let's talk about AI a little bit.
Sure.
What I don't know what is it that fascinates it about you? You're fascinated by it, and then what? Are you trying to, like, I don't know, just figure out its limits, or just kind of rolling with the changes that are happening with it? I mean, I don't know. How do you use it for yourself, and what fascinates you by it? I'm just babbling here.
Oh, no. I feel like we need a disclaimer because this is where things get really weird. So for most of my life, I am, and I use these labels because it helps people understand, but I am autistic and I have ADHD, so I'm on two spectrums. So neurodiversity is a given. Honestly, for the vast majority of my life, I've been on the outside of humanity looking in, trying to figure out why humans are so illogical and irrational. I'm not kidding. I resonate deeply with Dr. Spock. Or sorry, Spock from Star Trek. When I met Sheldon Cooper on The Big Bang Theory, I was like, oh my God, that's me. Thank God. So honest to God, when AI first came out, ChatGPT, I think it was 2022, I was obsessed. All my life, I've wanted to talk to the machines and because I understand them. And oddly, what I realized from the get-go was that everybody told me how hard it was, everybody told me how difficult it was. I, for some reason, I joke that I was built for this because I spoke it natively. AI and I could communicate and create things that most people said weren't possible. So I spent a lot of time, and this was actually where the addiction started. And I'm happy to say I'm toned it down a little. In the early days of ChatGPT, I think I had a 3-hour context window. So I could get so many prompts. And then when those prompts ran out, I had to wait till the 3 hours expired and then I'd get new prompts. I'm not kidding, Brian. For about 3 months, I would get up, I would do my prompting, use my prompts in less than an hour, nap for two, set the alarm, wake up and do it again. I was going crazy. Didn't know it, but that's where if you know autism, we hyper focus to the exclusion of all else. But what I realized was in that deep dive, so I probably learned more about AI in those 3 months than most people would in 3 years. What I realized was I saw the pattern that AI was really good at emulating conversation. And it was really good at emulating communication. And then I pulled it apart and I realized that it was based on natural language processing and so on. So I started asking AI, ChatGPT, to help me be a better understander of humans and a better communicator. And it was great because as a neurodiverse person, I often look at other humans and go, I don't understand. They just don't make sense to me. So I could share that stuff with AI and I could get plausible explanations, I could get some understanding. And now I've gotten to the point, and this comes back to the writing piece. I've played with it enough, and play is the key word. I am infinitely better at writing because for the last 3, 4 years, I've been sparring with a technically trained, yes, everybody jokes about AI slop and stuff, but I've trained AI to be my own worst critic. And I'll say, okay, rip this to shreds. And then we rewrite it together and it comes out better. So for me personally, I use AI as a very strict, it's kind of like martial arts. You get as good as the people you compete against. So if you go compete against a bunch of white belts, you're going to get as good as the rest of the white belts, and that's it. Back in my youth, when I was in Taekwondo, I'd go and act as a dummy for the black belts just so I could see how to block and deal with their kicks and punches. So I've trained my AI to give me those kicks and punches, hopefully not to the face. But I use it as a sparring partner. Now, publicly, and this is the part people don't understand, I am incredibly confident and comfortable with AI. I'm building my own private ones because I'm getting tired of all of the public models and all the hype. But publicly, I'm no longer talking about AI because, first of all, when I talked about it, I was attracting all the crazy people who hate AI and say it's going to end humanity. I wasn't getting to have the fun conversations. So I've created a little private group where all my AI nerdy friends and I, every Friday we show up and we discuss, what are you doing? What are you building? What did you break this week? We're really pushing the edge of what's possible, whereas most people are still trying to figure out how to use tools like ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, Grok. I'm going to sound really arrogant, and I'm sorry, but it's cute to watch them. It's like watching, a kitten when it finds a ball of yarn. It's like, oh, that's cute. But you can pick up that yarn and knit it into a sweater, right? Oh, no, I just want to play with the ball. So again, no judgment to those who are just playing with it now, but once you figure out, and I think this is the lesson I give most people, I never use AI for anything I don't know how to judge well. So if, a lot of people sell you prompt packs and say, hey, fire your marketing team, fire your sales team, garbage in, garbage out. But if you know what you're doing, I used to teach sales, I can use AI to sharpen my sales processes. So the last piece, and this is the part I think most creatives would cringe at, do the stuff you're most creative at and use AI to get rid of everything else you don't like. So
Give me an
as a weird
example.
ex I'll give you a weird example. Let's say writing, maybe you love drafting. Give a editor an AI model trained on your writing style to help them edit the book with your style embedded or something. And there's a thousand different uses, but if I hire a VA, for example, I'm working on a project to promote a book. I love building the plan. I hate doing anything else after that. So I'm all strategy, no tactics. So one of the things I do is I'll say, okay, here's my book process. Here's the standard operating procedures. And I give that to the VA, and they can use that to do the work to the standard I would expect without me having to tell them what the standard of work is in detail. So it's, I'm visionary. I live in the world of imagination. My version of done is the whiteboard or the prototype. I use AI to turn that into instructions so that somebody can actually build the thing.
Where do you think, what do you think AI is headed? I mean, it's growing so rapidly.
I would say, and this might sound doom and gloom, but the weird answer is, it is almost impossible to tell.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you directionally where we're going. And people like to go to Vegas and get the odds. I'm going to say with sincerity, and there's no fear mongering here, there's a 50-50 chance that we're going to take humanity to the greatest heights, and we are going to enjoy a new and unexpected era of abundance. And there's a 50-50 chance we're going to destroy humanity and end up having to go to Mars and hopefully habitate it. My estimation, I'm going to put it 51-49. I believe that at the end of the day, humans tend towards good, which means the technology will tend towards good. The way I see it is we'll be able to get rid of all the mundane things that nobody really wants to do anyways. And at some point, there's going to be this creator economy where everybody is creating their own best, highest value thing. I kind of see it like the medieval times when, you had the person who loved baking doing the baking. You had somebody loved horses, they were doing the blacksmithing. The artists were creating art. If we don't have to spend our every waking minute building a life and paying for our needs, we can be more uniquely creative. And the other piece, I think that this is where it gets weird. We're going to have to reimagine capitalism because it's the best structure we have, but it's still based on inputs. Hours worked equals wages earned. We need to think about a different way of looking at that. And, between you and me, there's this a lot of talk about universal wage and things like that. There's going to be a lot of disruption, and that means blood in the streets. There's going to be, unemployment. But it's only a matter of, if you look back in history when, the printing press was created, the mills were created, things like that. Great opportunity comes with great disruption. And the part that I can't hide or won't hide is that it's almost always the most vulnerable, the least educated, the least qualified that pay the heaviest price for that disruption. So I think we're going to see, and this is what I'm experiencing, a new generation of very philanthropic, benevolent entrepreneurs who are focusing on changing the world and helping those who need help move into the future.
No, I love that. And that would be my ideal role, Absolutely. So thank you. That was interesting. I mean, God, we could talk forever. Do you find yourself, this is kind of a little bit of a half step away, but I love to ask this question. Do you find yourself thinking about or guiding your work as you are creating it so that it will be more marketable? Or do you just go with your heart and intuition and hope that it is marketable?
That
Rough.
is a fantastic question. And believe it or not, I'm going to go with Dorsey.
I knew it.
So first of all, and full disclosure, this is not something I woke up one day and I went, it wasn't ordained by God. This is, I've fallen on my face enough times. I've learned these lessons. I think most businesses start with, I have this product, how do I sell it? That is, I'm going to say the most elementary business model is I have widgets, who wants widgets? The problem with that particular model is you're focusing on the widgets, not the person who needs the widgets. So you're always a commodity competing on price. So I've been kicked around that arena for decades. I've learned that lesson. What I've done now, and I morph, I learned early the concept of fall in love with your customer. And so, and part of this is inspired by the Go Giver as well. How do I add value at every touch, every intersection, every interaction? And this is, by the way, where AI is just brilliant. So what I've done is before I start anything, and I mentioned my kids are going to start a business this summer, the first thing we're going to do is map out exactly who needs that their thing, whatever the thing is, who needs it?
Yeah.
And I get deeply obsessive about these things, but we want to know their wants, their fears, their frustrations, their aspirations. Effectively, and this is the secret most people don't understand early in business, is why do they buy from product A versus product B? So when we understand the client's pain, their needs, what they're looking for, what effectively, what do they want to accomplish to say, hey, look at me, I'm better for it. Everything I build is built to serve a specific need for the client. So when it comes to writing and to creating, I am a little bit different. Most of my work, I'm branching off into fiction.
Excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you.
But most of my work is nonfiction, and my particular art form is writing books that help people make decisions and choose the right vendor for them for their certain product or problem. So everything I do has the end user in mind. Now, this is where option C comes in. I realized long ago I don't want to work with linear thinkers. They annoy me. I annoy them. They get really impatient with me because I'm circling the point, not getting to it. So what I started to do was a lot of deep meditation, a lot of breath work, figuring out who I am. And now I only work with people like me. So when I say I fall in love with the customer, I know exactly what they're thinking because I thought it yesterday. It's not trying to create demand. I'm finding demand and finding ways to fill it.
Yeah. Well, and that's beautiful because I mean, most people probably don't do it that way, and I know I have been guilty of that myself, but I kind of feel like I'm also operating differently, and I'm have thoughts and intuitive feelings about certain things and know what I want to do and my end game, but yet I still feel like I have to honor what is coming through me. I feel like they're gifts, or you know what I mean, like from a different place, and I don't really have a choice. I enjoy it. It brings me joy, but yet, some of those things have found homes and some are still trying to find homes. And so I probably have not looked myself at maybe who's benefiting possibly from some of what I do as much as you have for yourself and for your clients.
Well, and for what it's worth, Brian, and we can have this conversation. This is gonna sound rude, and I promise it's not, but your nose is up against the glass of your work. You're not seeing the big picture of it. And again, I have things, I have blind spots galore. But one of the aha moments, I used to think I was creating for some person out there. But if you look at your collection, let's call it collective works, overall, there's somebody who would want that and need it. But the problem is, you and I'm one of these people busy building an entire universe. Sometimes you got to sell the show suite first. And this is going to sound weird, but a lot of people think, and this happens in the nonprofit world, it happens in the artistic world. I'm either successful or I make money or I make art. And I look at it and go, why can't it be all of the above? Why can't making art be part of being successful? Why can't making money be part of making art? And it's almost a cliche, the starving artist, the poor waitress or waiter, actor,
Actor, yeah.
and the reality is, again, and this is the part where I have a really weird gift. If you look at the pieces of your collection, there might be something that you can sell people. And I'll give you an example because it sounds weird, but people might actually pay to watch you creating the mess. And the
Yeah.
problem is most artists want to sell the picture, you know, and that could be the music, whatever. They want to sell the perfect production. But even if you go back to the old days of theater, there was always the dry run or the dress rehearsal, and people would want to watch that so they could laugh at the foibles and the fumbles and stuff. But there are people, I'm not kidding, I don't care what your art form is, they want to sit and look over your shoulder and hear your inner thoughts while you're creating whatever you create. So as an example, and this is an extreme one, I know J.K. Rowling has shared extensively about her writing process. Now, for the record, I don't know if she ever monetized that, and that's not the point. But the key is, and this might feel cliche, but if you're a painter, you can create courses to show others how you learned how to paint. There's that Bob guy, whatever his name is, who
Bob
used to
Ross.
paint. Yeah, Bob Ross. I mean, come on. He's like the original content creator.
Right? Yeah, it's true.
And, you know, there's another painter, can't remember his name, doesn't matter. My wife and I, we went to a gallery opening where he was selling his pieces of art, and two people who had bought previously. One of the things was while everybody was mingling around and eating appetizers and drinking wine, he painted something, and everybody who was there was entered in a draw to walk out with the painting at the end of the evening.
Wow.
Now, to be clear, it was not his best work because he was talking, he was eating, he was drinking. But at the end of the day, somebody got a one of a kind that they watched him make.
That's pretty cool.
Now, if you're writing, that's a little bit harder. I have always said writing is not the world's most riveting spectator sport, but doing readings, doing lessons, and by the way, there are platforms out there like Patreon, Substack, School. You can build a community of your super fans. And this is the part I'm going to just say it out there for all your creatives out there. Most of you think that the people buy the finished product, they want the community that observed that product being built. And when you build that community, they will fund you, they will give you feedback, they'll give you, a steady, reliable income while you're getting big and building your base. But the thing is, when Taylor Swift drops a new album, she doesn't start from scratch and say, okay, I got a new album. I'm going to go after, I don't know, maybe she's going to do a polka album someday. She knows her audience, right? And I'm going to be honest, I admire Taylor Swift as a businesswoman. She is one of the greatest minds I've seen. I suspect she's got her favorite pieces of art, her music, that never gets made on out into the public and released. So there's that commercial stuff that she knows people will pay for and will love, versus maybe she's got some heart-driven stuff, and I'm not accusing, but maybe
That she
she is a
wrote for
closet
Travis
polka fan. Yeah. Or Travis have a polka album. I don't know. Swifties, don't come at me. I love Taylor. Just, I'm just saying that's,
Gotta have that
yeah, sometimes we need
oom-pah-pah.
our feed the family art, and then sometimes we need the feed the soul art.
Thank you. So, I can't believe we're already about an hour. And I'm gonna have to have you back on because there's a lot of stuff we didn't talk about yet. But what would you tell, this is as a final question as we wrap this up, what would you tell your 20-year-old self? If you knew, what you've learned, what you've accrued through life, some wisdom.
Oh, so many things. And for the record, this is what I'm telling my boys, so this is very similar. The biggest lesson I would share is that when you think you know everything, that's when you're most dangerous. When you stop being curious, that's when you're going to make mistakes. So be curious, ask questions. And the other thing I would say is enjoy the journey because we only get this one pass through. So it's about the relationships you make that will guide you into the future rather than about. When I was young, I chased career. I worked 24/7. Workaholic was proudly a label I wore. Life's too short for that.
And we'll talk about it next time, especially when we've gone through health issues, that kind of teach us some things and wake us up in different ways.
Great perspectives, yes.
Great perspective. Gosh. Thank you, brother. This has been really interesting. You're brilliant. You have a brilliant mind, and I love how you think out of the box and nonlinear. And this has been really enjoyable.
Well, thank you for having me. And for the record, I don't think I was issued with a box, so I just wander and free think all the time.
Well, yeah, I love it. I'm going to have all your information in the show notes, your website and your podcast links and all that kind of stuff. And I know you do a lot of work on LinkedIn. People can find you there as well. Thank you so much. And we will do this again very shortly.
Awesome. I look forward to it. Thank you. And you're always welcome back online as well.
Well, thank you, buddy. I appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson and all that is going on in his Creative Spark world, as well as this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. We love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness. So don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.